Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're going to talk about the automotive industry, and we have many areas to discuss this hour. The president, of course, announced new automobile fuel efficiency standards last week that require an average 54.5 miles per gallon by 2025. So we'll talk about that. And these new rules evidently contain a very intricate set of credits for auto companies to achieve the new target of 54.5 miles per gallon. What will it do to the price of cars? Why can't it happen earlier than 2025? Can you do it in a couple of years? My question. And we bailed out, you know, the auto industry in this country. What's happened to the big three? How are they doing? What cars are performing well? What's happened to automobiles as a result of all of the horrors in Japan? Are they up and running at full steam now or still having capacity that's much less than 100% because of the tsunami? And what else do we want to talk about? Oh, safety records, too. There was news this week that Ford is recalling vehicles. We'll look at cars that are coming out right now and what our guest thinks are really top-notch. Is there a movement for us to buy now instead of these big old SUVs? You still see a lot of them on the road, but are people starting to buy more fuel-efficient cars in greater numbers? Michelle Krebs is our guest. She is Edmunds.com senior analyst and AutoObserver.com editor-in-chief. She has covered the automotive industry for 30 years, having written for publications ranging from the New York Times to Motor Trend. Before starting her own business in 1990, she was a staff writer for trade journal Automotive News, covering the Financial Beat and General Motors Corporation. She's been an adjunct professor of business at Detroit's College for Creative Studies. She has served as the Automotive Press Association president in Detroit, as a juror on the North American Car and Truck of the Year, and as a juror on the Car of the Century. She's a graduate of Syracuse University, has an English degree and a degree in magazine journalism from the Newhouse School, and somehow picked up a avid interest in autos. I have that, too. I think it's because of my dad. My dad really liked convertibles. You know, he was so proud. I used to wash them every week, so somehow that's a part of the genetic makeup now. But now I kind of like cars. I like to wash my car and look at cars. Michelle, thank you very much for being with us.
So glad to be here.
Yeah, great to have you here. Let's start with this 54.5 miles per gallon by 2025. Do we gradually get to that point?
Here's where we go. There are already fuel economy standards in place that the automakers have to meet by 2016. That's an average of 35.5. Then these new rules would go into effect be phased in in different levels between cars and trucks between 2017 and 2025. Now, all the rules and details of that have not been made public yet. They will be in public hearing mode through September 30th. So a lot of the details will come up then. And then there's also a reassessment phase around 2017 to see if, you know, what's blocking them making it. Are we still on track to make those?
And why is it that it takes so long for us to get that kind of fuel efficiency?
Well, the auto companies have made great progress on gasoline engines, and we'll see a lot more of that. It's been a chicken and egg. We don't have electric cars and as many hybrids to buy. They're very expensive to make. When you know a hybrid car, for example, has basically two means of propulsion, so that means extra cost. We have a lot of work to do on batteries so that they have more power and can go longer distances, because right now the distances they can go just isn't particularly satisfying to most American consumers. So there's a lot of technology work to be done.
And what about the American appetite for this? Are we really hungry to get this kind of mileage?
That's the problem. Oh, yeah, we want it, but we want it at no cost.
Uh-huh.
And technology
uh-huh.
always costs money. I mean, remember your first computer and how much that cost and what your computer today does and costs so much less. That's the big problem. What we see is a very direct correlation between gas prices and fuel-efficient vehicle sales. So, for instance, in 2008, when gas went to near $4 a gallon or whatever it was, we saw a huge increase in the sales of small cars, small SUVs, and hybrid cars like the Toyota Prius. Gas prices come down, the reverse, those sales drop down. Of late, we've seen a lot of strength in the fuel economy vehicles, but there's also more of them.
Mm-hmm. I'm still seeing a lot of those big old cars, though, the vans and the SUVs. They're still all over the place.
Well, and you know, they are always going to be there because there are people who need to tow boats or trailers, or you know, they pickup trucks that are used for work. That's the majority of the sales of trucks are for people who use them in their work. So that's not going away.
Mm-hmm. Tell me what's happened with cars coming to the U.S. from Japan. I was at a dealership a few weeks ago, and
you didn't see many, did you?
No, and they said there weren't going to be very many coming in.
On March 11th, of course, everybody knows there was the devastating earthquake and the tsunami and then the subsequent meltdown of the nuclear, near meltdown of the nuclear power plant. The Japanese automakers were greatly affected. They had a lot of their suppliers were had production disruptions. Some of the plants that produce vehicles from Japan were hurt. And we also saw declines in the parts that come to the U.S. that make where they make the plant, the vehicles here also were affected. So the Toyota and Honda specifically have been very hurt by that, and it's taking a while to get their plants back into production, their suppliers back into production. So what you find is not much choice in inventory in the dealerships, and we think that has kind of suppressed all car sales.
Mm-hmm. But are cars like Hyundai and Kia doing better coming from another country?
Well, Hyundai and Kia have been on a roll for a long time, and this is only helping their situation. We saw Hyundai make great gains when Toyota had recalls a year ago, and they just keep coming out with great new products. So they are just doing really well. We're seeing GM, Ford, and Chrysler make a big comeback, and a lot of it has to do with everybody's introducing new products. And if you have the new products, you're going to win in the marketplace at least for a while.
Isn't that something, what you just said? Think about what we were talking about not that long ago. Everybody going under, and GM, Ford, and Chrysler are doing quite well.
Yes,
what happened?
Yes, they are. They've had, you know, good profits. They have got some terrific products. General Motors has got the Chevy Cruze, which is a big favorite among many of us in the press and analyst field. Last month it was the best-selling vehicle in America. Ford's got, you know, has done a really good job on small cars. They've got the Ford Fiesta and the Ford Focus, and they can't build enough of those. And Chrysler's merged with Fiat, so they're sprucing up some of their current products, and then eventually we'll be seeing new models that are a Fiat-Chrysler combination.
How do you determine, those of you who are in this business, when you said it's a favorite of yours, how do you determine that? What are you looking at in a great car?
Walking up to a car, the first thing you look at, does it have a design that's appealing? Then you look at, get inside, and you look at the, you know, interior quality, nice materials or not, compared to, you know, you have to compare it within the field that it competes in. I mean, you can't compare a $20,000 car to a $60,000 car.
Mm-hmm.
And then the ride, does it have a comfortable ride? Does it have a good response in terms of handling? Does it have good braking? So all those things and how that all comes together.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, you look at price and mileage.
And in terms of car sales, we're in this horrible economy. When you look at this year compared to last year, are things down or not?
No, they're up from last year, and they are up from overall. We're edging upward, but we've had a little missteps. June sales were not what we thought they would be. We're certainly not where we thought we would be at this point in the economic cycle. But a lot of that has to do with the problems with Japan and inventory. We think that if, you know, Toyota and Honda had a sufficient supply of vehicles, we'd see the overall boat lift in terms of auto sales. But auto sales has actually been a reasonable bright spot in the economy. Part of it is because people have kept their cars so long, they just can't hold out any longer on new ones.
What is the average length of time now for holding on to a car?
10 years.
Is it really?
Yes, it's hit, you know, record levels.
Wow.
I mean, on the one hand, it's great because it indicates that cars are better than ever. The quality and durability is fabulous. But for the automakers, it's like they'd like to sell you a new one.
10 years. I remember when I was growing up, my dad got one on schedule every 3 years.
Yeah, exactly. A lot of people used to do that. People don't do that so much anymore.
Yeah.
And they don't always necessarily stay with the same brand. Some do, but many don't.
Do you? In your business, I would think you want a different car every year.
Oh, I have 3 cars at home, and I have, you know, different brands. So,
right.
And I just buy what fits my needs.
Uh-huh.
Might not be my dream car, but, you know, we can't always afford what we dream.
No, that's for sure. That dream car could cost a pretty penny.
Yeah, and may not be practical at all for your needs. Reality gets in the way of dreams.
Let's go to phone calls. Scott in La Crosse is our first caller. Hey, Scott.
Hey there, Kathleen. Welcome back from vacation.
Thank you.
Good to talk to you again.
Thank you.
I had a disturbing experience a couple weeks ago. And it had to do with, I had been hearing that you're selling Leaf, the all-electric Nissan Leaf, and the Chevy Volt as fast as they can make them. And I stopped by the Green Drive Expo over in Dane County, as part of the county fair there, where they have all kinds of hybrids and, you know, home builds on display, and you can drive things. And I'm thinking, oh, wouldn't this be great? I can test drive a Leaf. Well, I go there, and I come to find out in talking to some people that some of the folks exhibiting there, that they're not even attempting to sell the Leaf in this part of the country, and it has to do with our winters.
Really?
Yeah, that the batteries just can't handle it, and a guy who had his own Chevy Volt on display there, one of the members of the Green Drive group, was telling people that what happens in the winter, the way the Chevy Volt works is, the battery is always what runs the vehicle. And Michelle, you'll have to correct me if I'm getting this wrong, but that the battery is always what drives the vehicle. But when the battery starts to get low, that's when the internal combustion engine comes on, just as a method of charging the battery.
Correct.
And he said that during the winter months. And he's had this thing, you know, since last fall or whenever they first came out. He said that when he was driving this last winter, that engine would have to come on immediately and run pretty much the whole time he was driving it, just because the battery needed that kind of support. And I guess that, you know, I mean, I'm thinking, oh man, great, an all electric vehicle. You know, you get the plug set up, and you can, you know, kiss the oil speculators goodbye, and I'm thinking, great, this is really looking good. And then I go there, and I come away going, oh, darn.
Well, Scott, what you're pointing out is exactly what I mentioned to Kathleen. We have a lot of work to do on batteries. First, let me back up. One of the reasons you're not seeing the Nissan Leaf in your areas, first of all, there's a very, very limited supply of both the Nissan Leaf and Chevy Volt. As you can understand, this is super new technology, and they are turning those vehicles out very slowly, very carefully, because we don't want any missteps in the EV market, because, if something happens with an electric vehicle, it could taint the entire industry. Remember the diesels of old that turned people off in America to diesels for a long time. Yes, you are right that the battery... really prefers a more temperate climate. I should back up. The Nissan Leaf eventually will be available everywhere, as will the Chevy Volt. What they're tending to do is to sell them in markets where they know they have that are bigger possible sales, because they want to get those volumes up in the economies of scale, and they're just doing a rollout, because they can't supply every dealer in the country with one. But so to your point about the battery, yes, it does. It performs better in more temperate climates. You would probably it doesn't particularly love great heat, but I found that true also when I tested a Nissan Leaf and a Chevy Volt, because it takes a lot more when it's cold to keep that battery going.
Yeah.
So you don't get the fuel economy, but you're still getting better fuel economy. I mean, we may get to the point. I think the Volt is a good step, because it'll get you used to the idea of battery, but you've also got a backup plan.
Yeah. What are these selling for, Scott? Were you thinking of buying one?
Well, the prices are still an issue.
Right.
As I understand it, the Nissan, and here again, Michelle, correct if I'm wrong, Nissan upped the price of the Leaf a little bit, and I think it's in the low 30s.
Mm.
And the guy who owned the Volt, he actually got his in Buffalo, New York. He said,
mm-hmm.
there, I don't know whether that's a point of entry for them or what, but he said he got his from there, and he wound up paying. They listed it $40,000. He said he got his for $47,000.
Wow!
There is supposed to be the $7,500 mm-hmm. tax break on it,
mm.
but that is you know your mileage may vary to make a bad pun here because or joke, but because it depends on what kind of tax you pay and you know what the item I get it, you know it's all bound up in whether you in other words if you don't pay that much in tax you're not going to get all that much back on it I guess. I was encouraged there though the thing that was encouraging to me and maybe Michelle you can fill us in more about that too is Toyota is a big participant in this Green Drive Expo. And the woman there was saying that they are on the verge of bringing out their RAV4 as a hybrid electric plug-in, and they did have some plug-ins available. You know, the plug-in Prius and all that. So it looks like they're moving in the right direction. And I'll tell you, I'm rooting for them. Obviously, rooting for them big time.
Yeah, I think we've just got to be patient. This is new technology. This is like you know the first computers, and they're going to be expensive, and there are going to be little glitches, and there are going to be idiosyncrasies. And in fact, you've got to decide if you're the right person to own one of these. On the pricing, yes, the base model of the Nissan Leaf sells for it's around $33,000, and yes, you get a federal tax subsidy credit that can be up to $7,500. There are also, there are some companies that if you buy one, they'll give you a subsidy. If you work for General Electric, I think there's a break. Some states do, some cities and regions do, so it's a little complicated. But and the Chevy Volt is up in the $37,000-$40,000 range.
That's a lot of dough.
But it's new technology. I think that we can't lose sight of that, and it will
right.
come down. I mean, the what we'll see is that technology move into smaller, less expensive vehicles. But we got to get the price. Believe me, the companies are not making money on these right now.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and that is not a sustainable economic model. So we will see this. And as the economies of scale grow and as we figure out ways to get more power into those batteries.
Michelle Krebs is our guest this hour, Edmunds.com senior analyst and AutoObserver.com editor-in-chief. She has covered the automotive industry for 30 years, and we're covering what's new in that industry this hour of the program. Thanks for the call, Scott. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And we'll be taking more of your phone calls in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this time period, the author of The President is a Sick Man. Grover Cleveland survives a secret surgery at sea and vilifies the courageous newspaper man who dared expose the truth. And yes, indeed, that is the entire title of the book. We like the author. He's been with us before because he wrote Harry Truman's excellent adventure, The True Story of a Great American Road Trip, which was a marvelous book. And this book talks about a little known event in American history. And it's a fascinating story and well told. And of course, there have been other times when presidents' health has not been common knowledge. We'll touch on some of those as well. But you're going to learn a lot about Grover Cleveland tomorrow on this show at this very hour. Our next caller is Scott from Shawano. Hi, Scott.
Morning.
Hi.
Another good show, Kathleen. Thank you very much for presenting all this wonderful information for us.
You're welcome, Scott.
I recently was looking at Mini Coopers, and they have a new vehicle out that's kind of a crossover. It's a little bigger than the standard Mini, but very much a Mini to look at it. It was real interesting to me. But the salesman told me that they will have a diesel. They have a diesel that's available of the same otherwise the same model in Europe, but it doesn't meet U.S. Emission standards, although it gets about 60 miles a gallon. So I wondered if your guests would comment on the status of diesel technology, high-mileage diesel technology, and when were you going to have it available on some of these foreign cars?
Very good question, because I'm a fan of diesels. We've got a real hang-up in the United States about diesels. There is this stigma that they are, remember the old ones that were clunky and smelly? I mean, think about the diesel buses, and they're loud. And I mean, I had a diesel rabbit years ago. It couldn't stand the cold, so you always had to plug it in somewhere to keep the engine warm. Diesels have come an amazingly long way, and part of that is because Europe has committed to it. They have done, that is the center of research for diesels, and they made amazing progress. So Volkswagen is very strong in diesels. The new Jetta has a diesel. They have a number of vehicles with diesel, BMW, Audi, and we will be seeing more. There's just a funny hang-up about it, and they do get tremendous mileage. We have an also odd tax structure here in that sometimes diesel is more than regular gas, and sometimes it's less, whereas in Europe it's always it's set up to be less.
It's set up to be less. How so?
Taxation, and the other thing that Europe does is smaller engine vehicles, you pay less tax on, and so it encourages people to, it changes consumer behavior.
John in Milwaukee, hi.
Hi, I wanted to go back to the Nissan Leaf and the Chevy Volt. There seems to be a competition where it looks like the Leaf is winning because it's a lower price and people are shooting for the lower price. But there's a difference between them, like you guys were talking about earlier, in that the Chevy Volt has the engine to relieve range anxiety. What my question was, it seems like the ultimate Leaf or car would be, for me, would be to get the cheaper version where it was all electric, but had the capability of me, say, going to a dealer and renting an add-on engine that would get rid of the range anxiety. And I was curious, that seems like a very logical thing to do, because the car companies could generate a new revenue stream. Where if you sold an purely electric car and were still able to take it on long-distance trips by just going to your dealer and renting a generator to put into the trunk or to snap onto the back of it.
That would never cut it with federal regulators in terms of safety and emissions and all that, because remember, these cars go through an immense amount of testing by the Environmental Protection Agency for mileage ratings, for emissions. They also go through a tremendous amount of safety, so you can't just add things on. There is some, what we really need to get to is faster charging and batteries that hold charges for longer and can go more miles. So getting there, there are some ideas, especially Nissan's looking at a lot of things in Europe and Israel. Swapping out batteries when, you go to you really only own the car, you lease the battery, you swap it out when you need a new one or need a charged one. So there's all kinds of new ideas being thought of. And, yes, believe me, revenue streams are not lost on corporations.
Okay. Well, that was just a suggestion.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Thank you, John.
Thanks much.
Yeah. Let's go next to Judy in Milwaukee. Hi, Judy.
Hi, and thank you for the programming today. It's been wonderful. I have a Honda Civic Hybrid question. I've had mine since 2003, and I know the battery, the hybrid battery, is less optimal than it has been in the past. And I am wondering, since it's not warrantied after 8 years, if it would be more sensible, if there's nothing wrong with the car, just to put in a new battery when it finally goes.
Boy, that's a good question, and I wish I had my my experts on this on the line. I don't know the answer to that, Judy. I would be talking to the dealer, and what do you do with it? And I think this is going to be an interesting question as electric cars and hybrids age. What do we do with these batteries?
Right.
We don't want to be in a situation where this is just something worsening the environment, because that misses the point of why they are in existence anyway. So I don't know if I can give advice on that. I'm sorry, Judy.
Somebody will, though. We've got a sophisticated audience. How do you like that car, Judy?
Well, just took a trip the other day, and I was at 52 miles a gallon.
Oh, my gosh. I like to hear that.
You know, I am looking at all those people who are paying $100 at the gas station, and I don't think I've ever paid more than 30, so...
And it's a 2003?
Yeah, it's wonderful.
Drive it as long as you can, Judy.
And yes, ma'am.
That's my advice to a lot of people.
And
drive
put a new battery in when it's time.
Yeah. Thank you, Judy, very much for your call.
Thank you.
We go next to Jay in Milwaukee. Hi, Jay.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call.
Yeah.
What about redeveloping a battery type like the EV1 had, which had a 200-mile range, or the other suggestion, what about multiple onboard mini wind turbines to recharge batteries that could be incorporated in body scoops, side body scoops?
Well, there's all kinds of things. If you remember, though, the EV1 was a two-seat car, very tiny, had lots of other, you know, aerodynamic kinds of things that would help with mileage. The problem is the batteries are so darn heavy, and, you know, the more you add, the more weight you add. That kind of forgets the purpose of why you're doing that. So the ultimate goal would be to develop batteries that are lightweight, that can hold a lot of power, can be recharged real quickly, and that we have so many of them that the price goes down.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where everything's headed. But it may take some time.
Anything else, Jay?
Well, I was just wondering about the concept of multiple mini onboard wind turbines for recharging. That could be incorporated in a car design. Interesting car.
An interesting concept. I don't know if I will bet you someone out there is working on that. There are a lot of people. not to self promote or anything, but I was made a mini appearance in a movie that's coming out, a documentary called Revenge of the Electric Car. And if you remember, there was a documentary film some years ago about the GM EV1 and its death, called Who Killed the Electric Car?
Yeah.
Well, because the electric car is coming back, the director decided to make the next movie. And so one of the characters that he features in the film is a guy named Gadget, who is the guy who works in his garage on electrifying cars. So, and there are tons of those all over the country working on all kinds of ways to get away from oil.
What's your role in the movie, Michelle?
Just as a commentator. So it's the movie focuses on four men in the auto industry trying to revolutionize transportation. Carlos Ghosn of Nissan being one with the Leaf. Bob Lutz, who's now retired from General Motors with the Chevy Bolt. Our man Gadget, who's the do-it-yourselfer. And Elon Musk of Tesla.
Oh, well, I have to see that. It sounds great.
It comes out in the fall.
In the fall, and it's a Revenge of the Electric Car?
Yes.
Okay, great. Well, congratulations. I didn't know I was speaking to a film star. Thanks, Jay. Thanks, Jay, for the call. We go to Royce in Madison next. Hi, Royce.
Good morning. My concern in all this is, I'm talking about the fuel efficiency standards now, is they've got so many little catches in it, and they don't seem to be using actual fuel mileage. They're basing this all off the EPA tests. And I follow Consumers Reports because they do actual fuel economy tests. And, like, you know, here the goal for, was it 2015 or 2016? I've forgotten. It's 35.5. You know, there's only about one or two vehicles that, when on real mileage, is getting that, you know, an overall mileage is even getting that now. And and then the other thing is, when they came out with this 54.5, apparently these aren't the mileages that are going to appear on the sticker.
And that's never been that way, just so you know that.
Well, yep. Anyway.
You raise a good point.
The bottom line is that nobody really knows what's going on in this whole area, in my opinion.
Well, you raise very good points, and we've raised those. We don't know all the details of what will be the loopholes, and we know there will be a bunch of them, because otherwise the I don't think the auto companies would have agreed to these, because they did agree to them. 2025 is a long way out there, too. And, you know, who's to say that with a different administration, which there will be at some point, and that could all change. The other thing that's always been a fallacy, is that the corporate average fuel economy standards that are set by the government, the 54.5 in 2025, the 35.5 in 2016, are measured differently than the EPA fuel economy ratings that you see on the sticker when you buy your car. So it causes some false sense of expectation, I think, for consumers. Now, on the other hand, we are seeing tremendous strides being made even in small internal combustion engines and gasoline engines. And, you know, we've got more 40-mile-per-gallon cars out on the roads today than we've ever had. So, and there are a lot more of those coming. So, yeah, it's not ideal. And we certainly share your concern.
Thanks, Roy. Scott in Green Bay. Hi.
Good morning. Yeah, I'm one of those guys that unfortunately puts on about 50, 55,000 miles a year driving, so I spend a lot of time in a car. And I also get to go to spend some time in Europe every year, and the one thing that always has driven me crazy is the lack of diesel technology here. I mean, I have a little Audi A4, which gets pretty good gas mileage, right around 30, 32, but the exact same vehicle, the diesel engine in Germany, gets 49 to 50
miles.
Ooh,
my. Wow.
And I actually talked to you can't get it here. I mean, actually trying to get that vehicle here, I talked to somebody, the federal regulation, it'd take about 6 months just for an application, and then our diesel fuel is so impure compared to what it is over in Europe. I mean, why don't we have more fuel standards? I mean, we've got all these little weird, you know, boutique fuels all around the country and in states and cities and that. Why can't we have better diesel technology? Because that would really help curb our use of fossil fuels.
Well, that's a very good point. Ours has not been as good. Europe has, you know, we have increased our standards, but still, they're not as, it's not as good. We also have stricter emissions. For say California, you know, an automaker has to say, "Gee, if I can't sell my diesel car in California, should I even bother at all?" So that it doesn't make for a very compelling business case. But yes, diesel is perfect for what your kind of driving.
Thanks, Scott, for your call. John in Conover, hi.
Hi, how are you?
All right, how are you?
Good. Every year I leave in October and drive my diesel truck down to Central Mexico, park it. And I get on my Polaris four-wheeler because they're street legal down there. And I drive that until June, and then I get in my truck and drive it back to Wisconsin. Why aren't we doing something to force states or counties or whatever to allow four-wheelers to be street legal and to even make some ATVs or four-wheelers that are battery-powered? Because my trip every day is, you know, at the most 10 miles.
I don't know that much about four-wheelers, but I certainly, if they were classified as a car, they would have to go through all of the same safety testing, crash testing. You'd have the insurance companies all over that. I would see it as a huge issue in terms of on the regulatory side, probably. I don't know that much about that part of the business.
What do they look like, John? I'm not familiar with these.
Well, they're just four-wheel drive motors. They're a four-wheel motorcycle.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
handlebars,
oh.
And
oh, okay.
Some of them are side-by-side seatings like the Polaris Razor, but you know they're for off-road, but they can be ridden on road. And
right.
I ride cobblestone roads. I can park anywhere. Or my gas mileage is minimal or is high. Mm-hmm.
And, I know what you're talking about. My family owns four-wheelers, and we have them on a farm, so. But, I think it would be, you'd have the Department of Transportation pulling their hair out.
Well, they need to be less hairy then.
Well, imagine those next. I mean, having driven a smart car, which is such a small car, and next to the big trucks on our roads, it boggles my mind.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, John. Thanks very much for the call. Nancy in Eau Claire, hello.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a 2001 Toyota Prius, so it's the first year that they came out.
Mm.
And I actually got it used with 116,000 miles on
oh,
it.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, I'm now at over 220,000
oh.
miles.
Wow.
I still get average daily 50 miles to the gallon. I drive about 100 miles a day for my job.
Mm-hmm.
So using about 2 gallons of gas a day. And I look at, you know, minivans and trucks and stuff. They're probably, if they're driving the same mileage, they'd be going through, you know, 4 or 5 gallons of gas a day. I've not had anything go wrong with my car other than regular maintenance. I've never had anything I've had to repair on my car, which has just been wonderful. But it is, you know, it's getting up there, even though everybody says, oh, that'll go for 300,000 miles. Don't worry about it. But I've been looking at getting a different car, and honestly, everything I look at, everything I investigate, you know, I do a lot of consumer reports and going online, just check everything out. Nothing looks as good as the car I'm driving right now. You know, all the new stuff coming out still doesn't get as good a gas mileage as my 10-year-old Prius with 220,000 miles on it.
I'm amazed. 220,000 miles.
I would keep it as long as you could, but have you looked at the new Toyota Prius, for example?
You know, I wouldn't be able to get brand new because they're too expensive.
Okay.
And actually,
well, and you raise a good point. I mean, that's part of the problem with new technology is it is out of reach for a lot of consumers.
Yeah, and if you even look at like a 2008, 2007 Toyota Prius, the gas mileage goes down on those. So as Prius got newer, they went through, you know, when they changed their style, their body styling, their gas mileage actually dropped.
Mm-hmm.
So it's hard for me to even get a newer Prius because they don't get as good of my gas mileage as my old one. So that's kind of frustrating, but, you know, they're at the same time, I guess it's good because I've, you know, I'm driving a hybrid. I haven't had any trouble with it. I get great gas mileage, and
you know, and you might get another couple years out of it, and by then there will be so many other things on the market, and there will be, you know, a new flood of used cars to select from as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
but I think one of the things Americans have to come to grips with, if they want this new technology and they want a lot more fuel economy, there is a price for that.
Thank you very much, Nancy, for the call. There's a car that's going to be really hard to get rid of. Well, here's a case in point where she got one of the very early Priuses, and according to her testimony, the technology really didn't improve a whole lot. It was best when it first came out.
Yeah, I'm not sure about all the details of that. Maybe I can't remember if that was smaller too. I just don't know.
Yeah. Isn't that something, though, that a car has lasted that long with that many miles?
That's why people aren't buying cars.
Yes.
Because they do last a long time.
Right. Remarkable.
That's a 10-year-old car.
Wow. Let's go to Al from Chicago. Hi, Al.
Hi there.
Hi.
You'll have to forgive me for being from Chicago, but hey.
That's all right. I'm from Chicago, too.
Okay.
Not for a long time, but it's all right.
I was listening to the news about a month ago or so. They had a report about the next generation battery, and they're saying it's still about 5 years out from us actually seeing it in the field. But I guess it's a pretty major breakthrough. And whereas it normally takes us, you know, like a couple hours to charge a typical cell phone, they're talking about total charge within about 5 minutes. And they're talking about applications going out to electric cars and all that kind of stuff. But I guess that's part of the problem with trying to, have these sweeping changes in the industry is it takes time to research it, and then they have to do all the field testing and stuff. And these breakthroughs it seems like they're pretty rare because batteries have been out for a while, but this was... It sounds like it's pretty major, and it came out of the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana. I don't know the name of the engineer who made the breakthrough, but it's on its way, and I think that's going to make the biggest change is being able to charge up a car in, you know, maybe 20, something like that.
Well, that's, and there's a ton of work. I know, you know, I'm here in Detroit, and Ann Arbor, University of Michigan, has a whole battery research operation. There's a tremendous amount of research going on, and, you know, the good thing is it's such a competitive market, there's a lot of incentive to do it, because if you make that breakthrough, you're going to be quite successful commercially. But, you know, there is a big leap to be made from the research lab to commercial use. And there's a lot of work going on in the chemistry of batteries. You know, we've gone from nickel metal hydride in most cars to lithium ion batteries in things like the Chevy Volt. So there's a lot of work being done in that. The goal would be to be, you know, Americans, consumers in general, don't like to change their behavior, so they want to go, you know, fill up in 5 minutes like they do with their gas tank. So there is a lot of work on charging stations where you can just top it off,
sure,
do a fast charge for 5 minutes that'll get you to where you need to go, and certainly cut down that overnight charging time.
Thanks, Al, for the call. We're talking cars this hour. Actually, we invite you also to talk about the 54.5 miles per gallon by 2025, the announcement last week that those are the new auto fuel efficiency standards. But, yeah, we'd like to talk cars, too. So we're looking at what's new and what's old and lasting for a long period of time. And what about what's happening in terms of car sales, what's selling well, what isn't, what's happening with the U.S. car industry. Michelle Krebs is our guest, Edmunds.com senior analyst and AutoObserver.com editor-in-chief. She has covered the auto industry for 30 years.
Oh, stop it, Kathleen.
Well, it's true, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
That's a long time. How
but
did
I'm
you
only 23.
That's all right. I've been doing this for 36, so I'm with you. But how did you become an auto journalist? I mean, it sounds like a great job, actually.
It was not planned at all. I was a Newhouse journalism student from Syracuse University, and I went to work for a newspaper in Florida, and then my best friend was working at a newspaper in Pontiac, Michigan, and I moved, and she went to Buffalo, and I became business editor at a time when, you know, newspapers were really beefing up their business sections. And if you want to cover business in Detroit, you cover the auto industry.
Righto.
So.
Yeah, that's how it happens. More phone calls in a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to phone calls, Mike in Racine is our next caller. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I got a question, but first a quick comment. To all the callers that got, you know, the ideas about attaching turbines to your car and stuff, we got to remember there's laws of physics involved here. And the bottom line is, if you're going to move a car from point A to point B, it's going to take, and it weighs a certain weight and has a certain wind resistance, there's always going to be an energy penalty, and you're always going to have to pay that. That's the law. You can't change that.
Absolutely.
But the question I have is for the guest is, why are we not seeing a push for harmonization of our safety standards and our emission standards with the EU? Right now, the emission standards in EU, this isn't the case 20 years ago, but now, today, and in the future, those standards are getting so close that they're, I won't say identical, but their goals are largely in the same places. They're easily harmonized, in my opinion. And the safety standards as well, I mean, there's not a significant difference, a real pragmatic difference between the safety standards in the EU and the U.S. I would think that the harmonization of those standards would benefit the American consumer, would benefit the goals of the U.S. society, and that we would open up an ability to import those cars directly. Because the big hindrance to importation of cars that are not sold here is those ability to meet those standards.
Yeah, it's a good question. Michelle?
Well, it's pretty easy. They're different governments with different, they want with different territories. I mean, yes, that would be exactly what the automakers would like, because then you'd have much better economies of scale. But, hey, we can't even get the states to be on the same page in the U.S. You've got
mm-hmm.
California and the northeastern states wanting to have their own emissions rules. So we aren't doing a very good job even internally of that. But mm-hmm. but we are, the goal is the same, and you even start to see it in China. Everybody knows we need to increase fuel economy, move away from fossil fuels, clean up the air, clean up the water, and improve safety for people driving cars, because there are going to be a whole lot more of them in the future.
When is China going to come up with some inexpensive, wildly popular car?
I don't think we're going to see a Chinese car per se sold here. There's still, when you go to China, which I have many, many times, their best cars and best-selling cars are largely those that they have worked on with a Western partner. General Motors has been very, very strong in China with its partner, because you can't go into that country without a partner. Volkswagen has been very strong there. But if you look at the homegrown vehicles, one of the companies that a lot of us watch is a company called BYD, which is a company in which Warren Buffett made an investment, because he thought they made their money in the cell phone business and then got into the car business. But they still have not made that jump to something that's really even viable in other markets. So of their homegrown stuff, there's not been any. They're just not there in terms of quality and that kind of thing.
Thanks, Mike. Sarah in Lodi. Hi.
Hi. I've seen a lot of ads on TV for natural gas-fueled automobiles, and I've never heard of them. And I'm just wondering if you have any information about them, and I'll take the response off the air.
Thanks, Sarah.
Good question. Yes, we're seeing there are natural gas vehicles on the road. A lot of them are for commercial vehicles. You have to have one of the problems. I mean, they've been around for a long time, and now we're seeing a little bit of some of the manufacturers like Chrysler and GM kind of got out of that market. Now they're coming back in because we have so much natural gas here, and we're looking for all kinds of alternatives. It's also, there are countries in Europe that it's very popular in, too. They require big tanks. That's one of the issues, and you don't have a natural gas station on your corner, so, there's the whole infrastructure issue. That is a huge issue, whatever fuel we go to. But Honda, for example, has the Honda Civic that you can actually refuel in your home from your own natural gas line. So they're out there.
John and Nina, hi.
Hi. I wonder whatever happened to Saturn. I have an 07, and I like it very, very much.
I'm sorry, but they're out of business.
I know.
Saturn was a General Motors brand, and when it went through its bankruptcy, General Motors eliminated Saturn and Pontiac and Hummer and then sold off Saab. I covered Saturn from day one before it was even Saturn. Kind of a sad story, because the whole premise was this great customer service. The problem was General Motors never fed it well with new products. It did near the end, but then it was too late. And then never really did a very good job of marketing the new products it did have. So
that's too bad, because I really like mine.
Well, what kind do you have?
It's a View, six-cylinder.
But which model?
Oh, gosh, I don't know.
Oh, okay. Because a lot of Saturns were Chevys underneath, so you might be able to get something at your Chevy dealership that you'll be as happy with.
Thank you.
Thank you, John. Carol is next in Madison. Hi, Carol.
Hi there. I would like to know why we can't talk to any CEOs in Detroit. We only get somebody in the Philippines, and we can't talk to the CEOs that manufacture the cars or design them.
You mean when you call customer service? Or?
That's right. I want Mercury Villager to be made again. It was a wonderful, awesome, phenomenal vehicle.
There's another vehicle and a product that's gone away. Mercury Ford has eliminated the Mercury brand. And minivans did not. Ford and GM never did a very good job with minivans. Chrysler really owned that market.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry about that.
Thanks, Carol, for the call. John and Toma, hi.
Yeah, my comment was just about, it's really not about mileage, but you've had a lot of people calling in about driving older vehicles with high mileage.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, just from what I've heard in my own personal opinion, there's nothing wrong with driving an older vehicle with high mileage, and I know the automakers have always had this thing where, every 3 years you need to buy a new vehicle. Well, they're just pushing that mindset on the people because they make money off those leases. But right now with the economy and that, I don't care what type of mileage you get. Smart bet is just to keep the car you got and drive it to the ground until it's ready to be towed off and not be spending money on a new vehicle no matter what type of fuel mileage you get.
Well, that's clearly what a lot of people are doing. That's why the average age of the car on the road is 10 years. But there are people that always want the newest thing or the newest model. Everybody has a... That's why there are so many cars to choose from, because everybody has a different goal and different taste.
Well, Michelle, thank you. It's been a lot of fun. We are just flooded with phone calls. People love to talk about cars.
They sure do.
I know they do.
Every place I go.
Yeah, good. Well, I'm glad you were at this place. Thanks, Michelle.
Thanks for having me.
Michelle Krebs, Edmunds.com senior analyst and also AutoObserver.com editor-in-chief. She's also been an adjunct professor of business at Detroit's College for Creative Studies. She is an award-winning writer who has served as president of the Automotive Press Association in Detroit. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this hour and to Rhonda Fanning for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. Tomorrow, just a reminder, during this time period, it's a fascinating story. The president is a sick man. It's about Grover Cleveland and his secret surgery at sea and how it was exposed by a Philadelphia reporter who was lambasted for even having the nerve to say this. That's tomorrow. Thanks for listening.